Even though Anya was trapped like a rabbit in the narrow dead-end street, she was at least out of sight behind the maze of hanging carpets, and that gave her a few moments to consider her options. A quick look both ways showed recessed doorways. They weren't recessed far enough to conceal her in daylight. To her right, though, stood the 4-foot-tall white shape, startling by its very familiarity in these exotic settings, of a covered metal trash bin. It wasn't good cover, but it was better than nothing. No sooner had she crouched down between the trash can and the wall than the first pursuer pushed between carpets not 10 feet from her. She followed him with one eye peering around the side of the can. He held a scorpion machine pistol loosely in his hand. Apparently convinced their quarry had bolted clear to the blank stone wall that blocked the alley, the Kosovar forged straight on through the next line of carpets without glancing to either side. But the next man through was clearly wary, frowning, with eyebrows like smudges of coal on his dark face, his head on a swivel. He was clearly more suspicious than his comrade. As he turned his face her way, Anya melted back behind the can. She knew nothing would grab his attention like rapid motion in his peripheral vision. She might as well whistle out loud. She could feel his presence looming closer and closer. She smelled the sweat and harsh tobacco that permeated his clothes. As he almost stood on top of her, she formed her right hand into an open fist and drove hard with her legs. The second Kosovar held his weapon, a Beretta 92 semi-automatic, muzzle high, unusually good firearms handling for a goon. He opened his mouth to shout to his comrade. The sword slid into his open mouth. She hurled herself backward into the recessed doorway. As dust blossomed from the carpets, Anya's right hand found the door latch behind her. Without conscious intent, she pushed the door open and half stumbled into cool darkness. She saw a set of rickety-looking wooden stairs. She bolted up them. Behind her, the Kosovar raced in pursuit. Anya's head swam. She turned, reaching behind the small of her back, but her legs buckled beneath her. She was on the third step from the top as the Kosovar rounded the base of the stairs and started up. He saw her and smiled. The gun in his hand was swinging toward her. Anya straight-armed the Glock. Re-energized by a fresh adrenaline surge, Anya jumped up, took the last steps at a bound. At the top, she found a fly-specked window overlooking the street of the carpets. Turning, she saw a hallway with doors to both sides, all closed. Another window opened at the far end, admitting a yellowish light. Stuffing the stubby Glock back into the holster inside the waistband of her pants, she ran for it. Shooting blind, the gunman failed to lead his target enough. That could change in a hurry if the window wouldn't open. Holding her right hand behind her, she summoned the sword. As she got in range, she slashed diagonally. Hoping the cuts had weakened the frame enough, she planted her left foot, skidded slightly on the floor, and thrust-kicked the center. Anya jumped to crouch on the sill. Almost directly below, she saw Pan Katramatos battling two Kosovars. Tourists and vendors scattered like a flock of frightened ducks. The man in front of Pan traced the shattered window to Anya, perched in the hollow frame. Pan availed himself of the man's distraction to give an elbow to the man trying to grapple him from behind. Then he whipped a front snap kick into the other man's left kidney. As the man lay face down on the broken glass, Anya dropped from the floor above. Anya found herself kneeling on the prone man's back. A pool of blood spread out from beneath his head.
Sorry.
Pan grabbed her hand and hauled her upright. He took off running uphill, towing her along like a tugboat. At this point, she appreciated the help. They made it up to another terrace and staggered around the corner to their left.
How'd you find me?
Followed the crowd. Once I broke the arm of the man who had me, they lost interest in me. Especially the way Duca was clutching his knee and crying like a baby. The police took him and Bajraktari, the other gangsters, took off after you.
So, where are we going?
Pan glanced back around the whitewashed corner of the building under whose overhang they huddled.
Right now, I think, just away.
He flashed her a quick grin. She grinned back. They ran. Around the side of the mountain ahead of them, 50 or 60 yards, a pair of men in green camouflage came trotting. One carried a black submachine gun with a curved magazine winging out to the left of the receiver. Fortunately, there was another street that headed off up the mountainside between the gorillas and them.
We're running out of village here. And where we're gonna find safety, I have no idea.
Don't worry, I've got an idea.
With nowhere good to run to, their only real shot was to run away and trust in their resourcefulness to turn up something. As they neared the intersection, a knot of tourists spilled from a chai shop right into the path of the two gorillas. The gorillas got well tangled up with the tourists. Anya and Pan pounded around the corner of a disreputable-looking hotel. There, they found four men standing in the street. Any doubt the Maoist gorillas were working with Bajraktari's Muslim bandits vanished. Two men were tall foreigners in black leather greatcoats, while two others were camo-clad locals, a whole head shorter. They were taken flat-footed by the sudden appearance of their joint quarry. Pan shoved the nearest gorilla toward the wall. Then he put his head down and charged to the nearer Kosovar. Pan charged the next big foreigner. The man met the challenge with a very professional-looking sprawl. He pushed the Greek cop down and away so he couldn't tackle him. One of the locals whipped out a kukri and grinned at Anya through a wispy beard. Clearly, he expected his big ugly knife to scare this soft Western woman into submission.
You've got the wrong girl for that.
It registered on her that the street was empty. The sword flashed into existence. Unlike most opponents, the Maoist stood his ground, weapon loosely gripped. He looked like he knew how to use the unwieldy short sword. Anya slashed at his face. He caught the sword flat to flat and guided it right past him. Anya then did a sort of stutter step and kicked him. Nearby, Pan was kickboxing with the second Kosovar. The first lay unmoving on his face. For a few vital moments, she could concentrate on her own unexpectedly formidable opponent. They went toe-to-toe, trading cuts. He was smart and fast and good. The down-pointed tip of the kukri drew a line of fire down Anya's left cheek. The gorilla had to throw himself backward, way off balance, to avoid taking her tip through his cheek. Then he made his first mistake. His eyes slid past her to the left. That was an old trick she'd seen before, but she saw his pupils widen too. Anya spun to her left, hacking savagely with her sword. The gorilla Pan had first knocked out took a step back, holding only half of the kukri in his hand. Anya looked back over her right shoulder. The first swordsman closed on her, his own weapon cocked over his left shoulder for a death stroke. That was his second mistake. Her back kick caught him square in the gut. The other gorilla stood flat-footed, staring at the end of his severed blade. Anya spun. The man she'd been dueling with brought up his blade. Stunned and short of breath, he was a beat slow. Blood sprayed from the man's arm. Not waiting to see what effect that had, she brought the sword looping up to her left. Anya released the sword, which was trapped by the severed ends of bones. The other gorilla turned and ran. Anya looked quickly around. She had no clue why the gorillas on the terrace weren't all over them by now, but she saw no sign of them. She saw Pan kick his opponent. As the man bent forward, Pan caught him with a beautiful uppercut. As he straightened, Pan drove a sideways elbow smash into his face. As she ran past, it was Anya's turn to catch Pan's hand.
Let's go, Pan.
By the time they reached the next terrace, Anya was almost reeling. Her adrenaline supercharge was running out. The thin air, accelerating the draining effects of fighting for her life, had her running on fumes, and thin ones at that. Pan labored at her side. He wasn't in much better shape than she was. A mixed group of gorillas and Bajraktari's men rounded the corner. Whatever had held up the gorillas, they had gotten it sorted out. The pursuers stopped to gape at the fallen bodies. Then one of the Kosovars pointed up at them.
I'm getting so sick of these guys. What are we gonna do now?
Down there.
Pan pointed to their left along the new terrace.
Somebody's signaling to us.
It was another group of Gaine musicians. A man danced in a doorway behind them with a red neckerchief, beckoning them with frantic hand movements. As soon as they made eye contact, he stopped, sat down, and began sawing his bow across his own sarangi.
Could it be a trap?
At this point, How much would that matter?
Good point.
As fast as they could without calling attention to themselves, they walked toward the musician. A small knot of tourists had gathered around him. Several members of the ensemble greeted Anya and Pan with smiles, handshakes, backslaps, as if they were all lost cousins. Hans passed Pan and Anya promptly up stone steps to the red-roofed house. The door was opened by a small, wizened woman with a white cloth tied over her bun of white hair. Anya and Pan whirled, but saw only strings of firecrackers. Pan grabbed for his Glock in its shoulder holster.
They've betrayed us!
Anya grabbed his arm.
Wait.
That racket will bring the bandits!
Anya smiled crazily at him.
It'll bring everybody!
For a moment, he stared blankly at her. Then, closing his mouth, he nodded quickly and allowed the smiling old lady to escort them into the gloom of the hallway.
A most fascinating ploy.
Chatura sat on a luridly colored cushion on the floor of a party safe house in the lower levels of the terraced bazaar town on the flanks of the Dalagiri Himal, holding tea in a blue porcelain cup.
After you convince me of the value of keeping this Creed woman alive and free, that she might lead us to reclaim a great treasure in the name of the people, you strike or cease to kill her yourself. One might wonder whether you truly have the welfare of the people at heart, Enver Bajraktari.
The Kosovar paced the room. Low square ceiling beams endangered his head. Despite the heat radiating from the iron stove in the corner of the room, he wore a wool sweater. He had his hands thrust into the pockets of his black trousers.
Not to mention using men whom I had lent to you to do it.
I saw the chance to act. I took it. If I acted rashly, so be it. Allah saw fit to fill my veins with the hot blood of action, not the cold blood of a snake.
An odd invocation for a follower of Chairman Mao. Fortunately, I need not rely on invisible spirits for my own cool blood. Or serpent blood, if you will. I find it interferes less with my judgment. Should I, for the sake of argument, accept your implicit claim that you acted because you saw an opportunity worth seizing, rather than in contravention of our arrangements of cooperation, it leaves the question of why your men sought to kill this woman and her companion.
Bajraktari stopped and scowled at the small man.
I owe the witch a debt of blood and honor. A Greek love boy as well. I thought if we had the chance to capture them, they would lead us to the treasure. And even if they died, what of that? We would have their notes, their records. We would know as much as they. If they could follow those close to the treasure, so could we. What I fail to understand is why we're not scouring the town right now in pursuit of them, pulling down the buildings and digging up the cellars. They must be here somewhere.
Softly, softly, comrade. The police are reactionary. The recent gunfire and fatalities have them swarming like angry hornets. They'd be happy to fight us, and they command more force in this city of bourgeois tools than we.
In the room's corner was a great duffel bag shape heaped horizontally on a pallet. Bajraktari walked over and hunkered briefly down to feel the sweat-glossed forehead of his henchman, Duka. The man stirred briefly.
It'll be all right.
He swept the stiff black hair back from the fevered brow and stood.
I hope he's ready to walk tomorrow.
We have provided him painkillers and a leg brace. Not to mention that our physician slid his patella back into place. He looks to be a strong man. Perhaps he will keep up.
Bajraktari frowned furiously. Chatura gave him a look of studied blandness.
And what of this Jagannatha? It is rumored he closes in on the Westerners as well.
We shall rendezvous with him north of town. I will instruct him to join his men to mine. Under my command, of course.
But what if he makes trouble? Your men all say he's a lone wolf who hates Western decadence more than he loves the Little Red Book.
Then I shall teach him the difference between being a wolf and being a dog.
Anya sipped her salty tea with yak butter. Pan Katramato sat across from her.
I'm afraid I'm starting to get used to this stuff.
An older man sat down cross-legged on the colorful rug across from them. Lal sat down beside him.
Such cheat, Gaine. Thank you once again.
The old man nodded and smiled. Once inside the red-roofed house, they had been led down a dark stone stairway and then taken by underground tunnel to a neighboring house, which on the surface was separated by almost 40 yards of open gray ground with only a few sprigs of dry weeds. There they were ushered back up into a whitewashed hallway, rushed out the back through a couple of what Anya could only describe as bare backyards, marked by stone boundaries. Beyond them, the ground dropped 6 or 8 feet, held up by retaining walls of stone. Farther out, the town petered out into a shield-like sheet of rock with gleaming ice patches. At last, they had come to this house, a pleasant 3-story structure with a green roof. They'd been surprised, if pleasantly, to meet Lal. He assured them they would be safe, and that his uncle would join them shortly.
The Gaine are pleased to be of help. These foreigners who hunt you have acted very disrespectful toward them.
I can imagine. That's kind of a habit of theirs.
What I still don't understand is how you managed to locate us, or anticipate us, as it seems you did.
My branch of the Mugger clan have always maintained good relationships with the hero singers, the Gaine. Though we had business to attend to, we asked their help in looking after you. Also, we had some of our younger kinfolk keep an eye on you.
That little boy in the bazaar?
Hi!
Anya saw a familiar figure in a long blue plaid shirt standing there.
Hi yourself.
I believe you have met my third cousin, Yuvraj.
We never suspected him. When he grows up, he should come work for Hellenic Special Forces. He could be a pathfinder, like me. Or perhaps best not, after all.
How'd you let Lal know we were coming this way?
Yuvraj smiled. With an upward wrist flick, he whipped open a cell phone.
How about the police? Are they looking for us?
Not specifically, although they would surely like to question you. I don't really advise letting them, you know. But they've got the idea the guerrillas are in with a foreign gang. Probably artifact smugglers. They blame them. Although strings have been pulled from a higher level, and they haven't been able to hold anyone. Even the injured ones brought in for treatment at government clinics.
Anya set down her tea. Her stomach had suddenly turned sour.
So the Maoists are working with the smugglers. Doesn't that make the odds against us pretty bad?
There are Maoists, and there are Maoists. Some in the government are probably tangled up in the smuggling, but others know our country needs tourism to survive. No one knows the value of the dollar like a communist. So while somebody used influence to get the injured bandits cut loose, the party at the highest level isn't going to go along with anything that might scare off the tourists. Not gunplay in a tourist destination, nor wholesale looting of national treasures.
But they seem to be willing enough to plunge the country back into civil war.
That is politics. When did they ever bring anything but sorrow and pain? And then again, there's Jagannatha. He's incorruptible, but he's also shadowing us. It is probably only on the orders of his own party superiors that he hasn't even yet made a major effort to wipe us out.
Why is that?
He hates and fears foreign influence on our country. He says that if we open ourselves to the Westerners, they'll enslave us, suck us dry, and discard us. Lots of people who don't care for the Maoists or their dogma agree with that, even among the religious.
What do you want to do, Anya?
I have a job, so that's what I'm going to do.
What about the people of the countryside?
Up here, most peasants are devout followers of what you'd call Tibetan Buddhism. The Lamasaris have a lot of influence. That means the communists are unpopular, the way they ridicule the people's beliefs and superstition.
What about Jagannatha?
As I said, he does not disrespect the old beliefs, and he treats the peasants well, not the way most of the guerrillas do, not to mention the party men from the cities who called the shots. The people are not hostile to him, as they are with the other Maoists, but not many actively assist him.
It only takes one to betray us.
You're on a great spiritual quest. Did you really think it would be easy?
Anya wanted to correct Lal. She was on a scientific quest, not a spiritual one. But she chose not to say it. There was no sense in antagonizing a good friend and invaluable ally.
So what's next?
We go high up. Though not very far as the crow flies.
You know where there's another hidden shrine?
Oh no, Sergeant Catramados. Since you both have shown yourselves worthy, you must now pass on to the next stage of your quest.
Trudging along snow packed down on top of layers of older snow, the new Sherpas, hired from the bazaar town, began to roll their eyes in apparent fear. Some made complicated gestures that Anya gathered were meant to avert evil. She was glad that once leaving the precincts of the bazaar town and the rule of law, however imperfect its coverage, they had broken out the long arms taken from Jagannatha's guerrillas. The weight of the M16 slung over her own shoulder was comforting. The fact Pan carried a similar weapon reassured her, as did the AKM, whose additional 10-pound weight Prasad added to his already heavy load without seeming to notice. They carried a number of extra magazines and boxes of ammunition. Trinkets, spices, camping gear, and hashish weren't all one could purchase in the Nepali bazaar. Lal had bought the ammunition in certain select markets. By devious means, they had been paid for on one of Anya's credit cards.
What's the matter, Prasad?
Footprints showed others had come this way since the last snow fell the night before. Prasad still scouted to make sure the way was safe, to watch out for hidden ice or overhanging snowbanks that might drop to swallow up the travelers.
The cry has frightened them.
What was it, my friend? Don't leave us in suspense.
Bon Manche.
Yeti?
Anya restrained herself from rolling her eyes. She didn't want to trample on local religious belief.
I hope it won't make them reluctant to continue.
They knew they might encounter danger, as well as hardship, but spiritual dangers strike deeper fear than mere physical ones do.
Spiritual?
The Bon Manche is a highly spiritual creature, as well as a physical one. Did you not know?
No, I didn't.
Pan looked to Anya, who shrugged. The porter's body language stayed skittish. The landscape around them turned blue as the sun declined toward the great peaks to the west along the unseen valley of the Myagdi River. There was little vegetation in evidence here. There was mostly just snow and chilled gray stone. They hiked over snow several inches deep beneath their hiking boots. Lal and Prasad had assured her they would face no technical climbing, at least on the current leg of their journey. She gave Pan a surreptitious look through her wraparound UV-blocking sunglasses. It was getting late in the day to wear them, but they were essential against the glare, amplified by the snow and ice, that could lead to snow blindness. At the moment, she was glad she wore them for another reason. By slow degrees, she felt Pan withdrawing from her. She was confused. Just when they seemed to be really coming together, suddenly came an unexpected emotional retreat. Her consolation was that he didn't seem to be drawing away from her so much as into himself. She was beginning to fear she would lose him all the same. The dreams were coming more frequently and stronger. Lying on his pallet next to her in the Gaine safe house the night before, he had stirred and muttered to himself in his sleep in the dialect of his Macedonian hill village. Then again, in the small, cold hours before dawn, she had awakened to find him sitting up, arms around his knees, staring fixedly at nothing. She worried that he was in danger of losing himself to memories of someone he never was and a place he'd never been. Then she wondered if he had seen her sword. No easy answer came, nor could she see her way to asking him. The path veered out of sight around a fairly sheer shoulder of what seemed to be mostly granite. Another lesser peak rose ahead, across what looked like a narrow valley. Lal slipped cautiously around the boulder, then signaled the others to follow. The procession wound around. They entered a valley slanting steeply up the mountain. The path wound up the right side. To their left, a stream poured down the center of the narrow valley in gleaming zigs and zags. The mountains blocked the lowering sun. The temperature dropped perceptibly. Anya zipped up her parka. A child of the hot, humid Mississippi Delta, she'd been astonished to learn that in really cold climates, it wasn't keeping warm that was the problem, unless you were just completely unprepared. It was heat management. If you bundled up too tightly, you could get overheated in a frighteningly short time, exhaust yourself, fuddle your wits, and finally pass out. Worst case, you could die. Beside her, Pan walked along, his face thoughtful, even somewhat sad. She compressed her lips and shook her head, wishing she could reach out to him.
How much farther?
Prasad kept forward, leading them around a bend. Anya then became aware of an orange glow ahead.
We are here.
Before them stood a lamasery. It was three stories of dark wood and gray stone and sweeping eaves with demon faces carved in every beam end. The faces seemed alive from the motion of the leaping flames of the thousand torches that surrounded the place. From the middle of the roof, a giant bonfire danced high against slopes covered in dark hemlock forest.
Behold, the lamasery of fire.
A fresh-faced young man in a saffron robe and a shaved head had greeted them at the main entrance. Slow, fat flakes had begun to fall from clouds that had closed in with alarming swiftness low overhead.
Wow. So you're American. It's good to see somebody from back home. Good to hear the accent, you know?
Pan and Anya exchanged looks. Anya shrugged.
I am American. I'm Anya Creed. This is Sergeant Pantheras Katramados of the Hellenic Police.
She would have introduced Prasad and Lal, but they and the porters hung back by the large wooden gates as if this did not concern them. She felt strange acting like some lady of the manor with her retinue of servants, but she felt bound to respect their wishes to hang back.
Wow, that's Greek. You're sure a long way from home. Pleased to meet you, Miss Creed, Sergeant. I'm Sokshen Rinpoche. I know that's kind of a tongue twister, so you can call me Ricky.
Ricky.
Well, welcome to the Lamasery of Fire. Now, if you'll all follow me, we've got rooms waiting for everybody. Once you're settled in, we can eat and talk. You must be famished. I know I am.
He turned and walked back between the huge double doors of the monastery. Inside, through a short foyer, Anya could see a high-raftered room lit by many torches burning in sconces along dark wooden walls. He just looked like an all-American kid to Anya. Maybe he was part Japanese, but he was all-American. She and Pan found themselves sitting in a room with a great hearth and many oil lamps hanging from standing black iron candelabra. Anya was relieved there were no torches. Lama Ricky sat on a little dais facing Pan and Anya, who sat cross-legged on carpets on the floor. Silent, shaved-headed acolytes in red or saffron robes laid out a variety of covered porcelain dishes between them. At their host's gesture, they began to open the pots. Through curls of steam, they saw heaps of rice, steamed vegetables, something in a sauce that suggested curry. They began to serve themselves with copper spoons.
Forgive me, please, but Ricky seems a very strange name for a monk high up a mountain in Nepal.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? I used to be plain old Richard Yamazaki of Cleveland, Ohio, back in the day. But then I started having these strange dreams and waking visions. One day, these guys showed up at my door and claimed I was the 34th generation of the Sokchen Rinpoche, a tulku.
Tulku?
Yeah, the 34th reincarnation of a bodhisattva.
Well, that's one who has attained enlightenment and has vowed to continue returning on the wheel of reincarnation to help enlighten all beings, isn't it?
That's right. There were these prophecies that predicted my incarnation. The previous Dzogchen Rinpoche left behind a song that predicted where I'd be found. That is, him come back and everything. So they tracked me down and set me a series of tests. I was shown a bunch of books, prayer beads, ritual stuff like that. It turned out what I picked was what belonged to him, or to me, actually, in a former life. I know, it sounds crazy. Well, it seemed pretty crazy to me, too, at first, but it all turned out to fit. So, here I am. But that's not important. It's not why you're here. That's all about your journey.
You know about us?
Sure. Old Om Prakash down south in Lumbini sent Miss Creed on a course to here. He let us know to expect you both.
But I never told him about Pan, about Sergeant Katramados. I didn't even know he'd be joining me.
Om Prakash is a wise old dude. Very powerful spiritually. He knows things.
Pan continued to frown.
The local population feeds the monasteries, Pan. Don't you think the grapevine reaches here?
Her companion's craggy face didn't exactly soften, but it did unclench a bit. His shoulders relaxed slightly. Their host ate rice from a bowl held close to his mouth with chopsticks and gave no sign of having heard the comment, but his dark eyes danced. She was glad to see Pan coming out of his own head, even if it was to get a touch paranoid with their host. He'd been brooding so much on the past.
You've got me confused.
Good. If you think you've already got it all figured out, how can you learn anything?
Well, I'm willing to admit I don't know what's going on, especially if it'll speed things up a bit.
Ricky's expression surprised her. He didn't look offended. Nor did he show the same easy grin he had to almost everything else.
Don't be so eager to rush into the future. You don't know what it might hold.
We all die. I know that much.
And you should know that's not necessarily a career-ending injury, Pantharas.
What do you mean?
You know. What goes around comes around.
So you know what we're looking for. Can you help us find it?
I can point out signposts, but only you can find your way. Sorry, coming off all mystical and cryptic just goes with the job. Anyway, you already know that 20-some centuries ago, this young punk came out of the West, crashing into India, breaking things and killing people.
You cannot speak that way of Migos Alexandros. He was a great man. He built cities and carried civilization.
We had civilization around here already. You know what I mean?
But he was my childhood idol.
Right.
Pan slumped. He seemed slightly abashed and mostly confused.
You know how he found out about the highest shrine, away up the White Mountain. And he sent his most trusted general to go and grab it for him. You've been following in his footsteps, right?
Neither of the visitors said anything.
So you still are. He was found worthy to come this far. Now, so have you.
You, your predecessors, found him worthy to steal your greatest treasure?
If that ancient warrior, Pantharas, had succeeded in his quest, he'd have found a treasure valuable beyond his wildest imaginings.
Did he take the treasure then?
Do the histories talk about him getting a fabulous treasure back to Alex?
They don't recount that he ever returned at all. He was a Macedonian, one of the elite. He would not have come slinking back a failure. As the cliche goes, he would have come back with his shield, or on it.
But that doesn't mean he never found the treasure.
No. That's not my place to tell you that either.
Ricky reached behind himself and produced a beaten brass tray. On it rested a scroll tied with a dusty scarlet ribbon.
All I'm here for is to provide you with this.
Oh.
You know the drill by now. General Pantharas left behind a written record of his journey up the White Mountain to find the highest treasure. The monks copied it carefully and faithfully, time and again across the centuries. And now, I leave you to your studies. If you need anything, let one of the brothers know and they'll get it for you.
Ricky bowed, then started for the door. Anya got to her feet. She was worried about Prasad and Lal.
Your men have been shown to rooms of their own and are being fed, Anya. When you're finished reading, a lama will show you to your own room.
He walked out. Pan still sat. His eyes were fixed on the scroll. Although she'd eaten little, Anya forgot hunger in her eagerness to learn what was in the fragment. From her pack, she produced thin disposable gloves for them both. Carefully, Pan untied the ribbon. He unrolled the scroll and began to read. For several minutes, Anya sat in silence. Her eyes never left his as they tracked line by line down the yellowed, brittle parchment.
Pantharas has learned that his path from here leads high up the mountain. to a place called the Lost Lamissary. It is a place even the monks speak of with trepidation. Terrible dangers guard it, natural and otherwise. He's even heard rumors it is guarded by demons.
Demons?
It is, he writes, a destination from which the unworthy never return. By the time he reached here, the general had lost most of his party, the greater part to a recent avalanche. He writes of growing disillusionment, with slaughter, with Alexander, with the world. Madness and fear seem to be overcoming the few remaining members of his expedition. He's lost his taste for treasure. He seeks now for peace within his soul. This seems strange to him, but the teachings of this land's people offer just that. Not the favor of fickle deities, but lasting serenity, something he's never imagined before. But he is a true son of Macedonia. He will carry out his orders, whatever the danger, whatever the cost to himself. He will deliver the treasure, as charged, to the highest and most powerful lord.
He tied the ribbon around it again and set it back on the tray. Then he settled back with his hands on his thighs and his head down.
The avalanche struck them as they were crossing the site of the present bazaar town. A huge snowpack slid from the great granite shield above the town. Pantheras's men called upon him to save them, called upon the gods, but he and the gods alike were powerless to help them. They were swept away, down the mountain, crushed and buried.
That's in the fragment too?
No. I saw it last night, in my dreams.
The torches of the night before were extinguished. The white light of morning shone down into the chamber from windows set high up in the rafters. Anya and Pan sat eating breakfast with Sokchen Rinpoche, who had resumed his earlier place on the low dais.
You've learned what you came to learn.
Anya noticed he did not ask if they'd slept well. She got the very strong impression that he knew. It didn't take mystical second sight to see the bags under their eyes.
I suppose so.
Although they shared a room, it hadn't been any kind of happy recreation that kept them awake. Once more, Pan had spent the night tossing and turning and crying out in a strange tongue. Anya feared his fantasy of a past lifetime had trapped him and was dragging him inexorably in.
What can you tell me of this lost lamissary? Does it still exist?
Oh, yes. Still there. Still lost.
But surely there's no danger in trying to reach it anymore.
Oh, yeah. Yes to the danger, that is. It's a very holy place. Its keepers can't risk allowing it to be plundered and defiled by every stray conquering Sorry, Sergeant. Bandit or doctrinaire atheist gorilla who wanders by. And somehow, you know, millennium in, millennium out, there's always been people like that running loose in this part of the world. Must be the air, or maybe the height. It's a very perilous journey, and just like General Pantheras, you've got to pass through the Lost Lamissary to complete your journey.
You've got to be kidding.
Nope. That's karma. The real deal. Not the wishy-washy, watered-down, new-age kind we hear about back in the States, you know? Sometimes it's your duty, sometimes it's your fate. Sometimes it just sucks.
Pan nodded, as if these words held deep meaning for him.
Duty is something I can understand. Something we both understand.
So if this place is really so lost, how are we ever going to find it?
I will tell you.
Lal was marching just in front of her and Pan as they climbed Daulagiri. The sun hadn't quite reached the zenith. Anya's head whipped around. The dark figures winding around the mountainside half a mile behind them filled them all with dread. Prasad was in the point position.
I hope they do not shoot. It could bring the mountain down on all our heads.
The slope above them was steep and white. To their left, it dropped away dizzyingly into depths hidden by clouds of snow blown by a stiff wind that fortunately didn't reach this high.
We should move.
Anya nodded. The little procession began to wind its tortured way along the face of the mountain once more. She looked at Pan. She was pretty experienced in combat herself, more so, she realized, than most men in frontline combat units. Pan had been stuck deep into the most harrowing and constant special ops in Afghanistan. And he was the professional, after all.
Well, what do we do now?
Keep moving. That's all I can see. And the only ways to go are forward or back.
It does simplify our choices.
Lal, what do you think?
For once, young Lal wasn't smiling.
You're right, Sergeant. But we and they each hold a blade.
What do you mean?
They can move faster than we can. There are more of them, and they're more lightly laden.
What about the newbies?
Jagannatha and his men had been following them for some time, but a new and less disciplined-looking group had joined them.
If they fall, their comrades won't even stop to watch.
So what's our advantage? That's the part I want to hear.
Out here on the narrow trail, neither side dare shoot. Even without the avalanche threat, we'd just slaughter each other out here in the open with no hiding places.
Jagannatha might risk that. He hates the Western influence. He fears what you'll do to the country and the people if you find the treasure. He'd rather die than see you turn the highest shrine into Disneyland.
Like I do that.
Voice, Anya.
Anya put her hand to her mouth, with a cringing, contracting feeling in the pit of her belly. She knew how dangerous it would be to shout up here with tons of snow hanging over you.
Sorry.
In his way, the Major is a true fanatic.
I thought you said he lapsed from his communist faith.
And so he has, Sergeant. Yet what he believes in with the convert's fervor. And he believes he stands alone against the forces of what you call globalization.
Why haven't they just opened fire and finished it then?
Because he is no longer alone, nor, it is probable, in charge. Lowlanders have recently joined them. His political officer and followers, no doubt.
Wouldn't a devoted Maoist want to stop us at any cost, too?
They want the gold, Anya Creed. No one lusts after gold like a communist.
They'll want to catch us and use their kukris.
Note also the much taller figures who walk among them.
Bajraktari.
It would certainly appear your outlaw countrymen walk among them.
Not my countrymen. Once we hunted them with spears, like wild beasts.
Pan noted the way Anya was staring at him.
Pan, stay in the present. We need you here and now.
For a moment, his eyes blazed with anger. It was replaced quickly with confusion, then contrition. He lowered his head.
You're right, Anya. I cannot afford this sleep.
They came to a frightening choke point where they had to turn faces to the rock and inch along. Despite her precarious foothold, Anya risked a look back. It seemed their pursuers had closed the distance somewhat.
So, I still haven't heard what our advantage is.
The path won't stay narrow forever. Sooner or later, we'll reach a spot where we can leave it, fan out, and find cover to shoot from.
So it's basically a race.
Between their knives and our rifles, yes.
As the afternoon began to wear on them, the trail never widened much beyond shoulder width, narrowing all too often to something little more than a dubious toehold. The pursuers were gaining, but slowly. Anya looked behind her. She saw a dark figure plummeting away from the narrow string of pursuers. She cringed in what had become reflexive fear that the man's wail of terminal despair would bring on an avalanche. She noticed she wasn't the only one. These high mountain men were hardcore, but they were still human.
That's two in the last hour. That one was a local, I think.
The first pursuer to fall had been taller than most of the enemy party. They were close enough now, Anya could recognize the tall, gaunt shape of Bajraktari still with them, the bear-like bulk of his shadow, Duka, limping painfully and determinedly along. Apparently, the kneecap she'd displaced had gotten treatment, but it had to hurt like a monster to walk on, especially like this.
Prasad, how much farther?
Not far. Another hour or two.
That may be too long. They're getting close. If too many of them slip and go over, they may do something desperate.
Their guide shrugged beneath the straps of his bulky pack.
What will happen. If you are worthy, nothing will stop you reaching your destination.
What about you, Prasad?
It is not our spiritual quest. What happens to us matters much to us, but little to fate.
Storm clouds ahead. We shall be in it soon.
Sounds like we're in trouble.
Not necessarily, Anya. The storm ahead can be good for us. It will shield us from our enemies' eyes and make their hearts quail.
It was already having that effect on hers, but she decided not to say it. They edged around the boulder. Anya hugged the harsh stone tightly. She felt air beneath her heels. The weight of her pack seemed to try to peel her off backward. Then she was around. The trail widened to a luxurious 5 feet. Safe as the living room of her loft back in Brooklyn, it seemed. But ahead, the storm clouds piled higher than the great mountain and grayer than the rocks. Whiteness swirled no more than a quarter mile ahead, obliterating sight. Anya noticed several of the porters hesitating ahead.
Are they afraid, Prasad?
Some think the demons come to prevent us from reaching the monastery alive. But don't worry. Others feel the storm is brought by the mountain spirits who protect the lost lamasery. They think they're there to help us.
How long must we wait for vengeance?
Anver Bajraktari kept his concentration until he finished inching his way around the big rock protrusion that reduced the trail to little more than a suggestion. Then he stepped out where it widened. In front of him, one of Chatura's men, armed with a black British submachine gun, and one of Jagannatha's men with a Kalashnikov, walked point. Their two leaders moved just as suspiciously behind them. The tall Kosovar helped Duka around the last of the narrow shelf and aided him in limping to the wider area. Then he looked back to his giant bodyguard.
Can't you at least wait to whine until I'm off that damned knife edge?
He was trying to keep his voice down. Their local helpers had impressed on them the necessity of keeping loud noises to a minimum. Their quarry still had a good lead. They were too far away for accurate shooting. Besides, both Chatura and Jagannatha had impressed on him that gunfire was strictly a last resort up here amid the snowpack. He assisted Duka for a few halting steps until he seemed able to proceed on his own. Normally, he'd leave stragglers behind without a thought. But Duka was a special case. He was loyal. That meant something in this treacherous age. Ahead, he saw Chatura and the new man, Jagannatha, trudging side by side. The major was like a dog forced to walk placidly beside a cat. Or perhaps he was like an old wolf. He knew that one was dangerous. As a matter of traditional business practice, Bajraktari had been contemplating the possibility that Chatura might not make it off the mountain alive. The little pot-bellied infidel was annoyingly smug and superior. His elimination would leave the more for Bajraktari and his men. And unlike his men, of course, the commissar had no extended family back in Kosovo who cherished the same blood feud traditions as the Bajraktaris. But Jagannatha was cut from different cloth. A highly dangerous man himself, Anver Bajraktari prided himself on his ability to read the signs. And clearly the major had no more use for the Kosovars than he did for their quarry. Nor did he have any use for Chatura and his swaggering, city-born political thugs, who all had their tongues hanging and their feet dragging. The problem, Bajraktari saw, was that he and his men most clearly needed Jagannatha's help to get to the treasure and get down with it alive. He felt that it was in Allah's hands. The evil mountain would itself thin the number of hands reaching for pieces of the golden pie, he suspected. And he wasn't naive enough to believe they'd finish off the treacherous Anya Creed and her companions without getting well bloodied. And when at last the treasure was in their hands and the Creed woman and the policemen were dead, hopefully after a very great deal of pain, Anver Bajraktari was just the man to sort matters out. He was good at that sort of thing.
Boss!
Yes?
Storm coming.
Bajraktari looked beyond the brightly colored line of the party they pursued. The thick, gray-hearted clouds that had been gathering about the mountain now swept toward them with swirling skirts of white. Without regard to safety, he began to jog forward. He had to talk to Chatura and Jagannatha.
They come!
Anya tore her eyes from the snow squall flowing around the mountainside to meet them. A large group of pursuers had separated themselves from the rest and advanced quickly in open pursuit, heedless of the treacherous and now icy trail. Heavy curved blades gleamed dully in their hands.
Juggernaut.
He knows once we're in the snowstorm they've lost us. Wise old wolf that he is.
The Kukris.
They do not wish to risk avalanche. They intend to do their work with blades.
I'll deal with it.
Anya stared determinedly toward the rear of the procession. If they wanted to play with sharp things, she was their girl. A hand caught her arm. She spun, frowning. It was Pan. He released her as if her arm had gotten hot.
Sorry, but where do you think you're going?
Most of our Sherpas are unarmed. There's only a couple of Prasad's kinfolk left. I'm not about to ask them to fight my battle while I scuttle for safety.
Why not? They won't be alone.
She realized he had a length of steel in his right hand. It was serious steel, with a wide, single-edged blade a foot long tapering to a wicked point.
Where'd you get that?
Afghanistan. Souvenir. It's called a Khyber knife.
You're a man of surprises, Pan. But I can't let others fight my fights. Not even you.
You fight remarkably well.
Pan left the "for a woman" unsaid. It didn't sting her particularly. She knew it wasn't male chauvinism, or not purely that. A woman could rarely hope to hold her own in a face-up fight with a man, and she still couldn't explain why she was the exception. A short, sturdy figure appeared beside them.
Prasad?
Lal will lead the men onward as fast as he dares. I will join you in the rear guard. If Lord Buddha smiles, the snow shall spare us the need to fight.
But Anya...
Do you truly not see it, my friend? She is a spirit warrior. If anything, it is she who will protect us. Now we must go.
They paused to let the Sherpas pass them. Fortunately, the porters, mountaineers by birth and bloodline, had been holding back for the benefit of their outland employers. Now they moved like eager mountain goats for what they obviously thought of as the welcoming shelter of the blizzard. Anya wished she could feel the same about it. She, Pan, and Prasad took up position at the end of the line. The pursuers were no more than 50 yards back. Walking backwards, trusting to the body sense imparted by her training in martial arts, Anya could clearly see the grizzled red face of Jagannatha between his fur collar and his big fuzzy cap. It chilled her in a way the rising wind couldn't match. She realized she was looking at the face of a man who was neither criminal nor madman, but who had set his own interests aside to do what he believed was right. In that seamed, stern face, she read neither anger nor hatred, just determination. For whatever reason, Jagannatha saw Anya and her mission as a deadly threat to his homeland, and he was as unstoppable as a runaway train.
Anya?
Pan was still clearly unhappy about her being there. He was all hardcore Special Forces vet now, and wasn't buying any spirit warrior nonsense, which at least meant he was wholly in the present. Anya shook her head. Most of the men she'd killed in the past were clearly bad, but she was unsure about Jagannatha. She almost felt as if she didn't have the right. She shook herself all over and caught a grip. If Jagannatha attacked, she had the unbreakable right to defend herself. His motives didn't matter. You couldn't really know them anyway.
Miss Creed, the storm comes swiftly. Lal and the first men are already within it. We must hurry.
Anya caught Pan's eye. They turned and raced full speed behind Prasad for the storm. She'd never considered a violent Himalayan snowstorm could be used as shelter. Then she plunged into the white maelstrom.
They're getting away!
Though dizzy from the thin air and nervous on the slick footing, his men had begun to hurry once Jagannatha took the lead, as if unwilling to leave the pleasure of the kill to the locals, who after all were infidels. Bajraktari hung back. Dukha still found this heavy going. Chatura and most of his lowlanders stayed back of them, content to let others do the hard part, yet reap all the rewards afterward. He looked up from aiding Dukha past a slick stretch to see the woman and her party moving into a curtain of snow and mist so dense he couldn't see into it at all. Their curious knives in hand, Jagannatha and his men trotted after them. They were still much too far to close the gap. One of Bajraktari's men raised his Kalashnikov toward the fleeing group. Two of Jagannatha's men stumbled. Jagannatha turned. He brought up his antique Chinese-made Mauser with two gloved hands. The man dropped the heavy rifle and fell over backward, arms outflung. His eyes stared with uncomprehending fury past the small blue hole in his forehead. But the damage was done. Bajraktari looked up the mountain just as tons of snow broke free and slid downward. He grabbed his gigantic bodyguard and flung him against a boulder jutting from the mountainside. Then he tried to make himself very small. Anya watched as the avalanche came down. A strangely coherent mass, at least 100 yards by maybe 30, started sliding downward and outward like packed snow from a pitched roof. It hit the pursuing group of guerrillas and Kosovar bandits and washed them out of view and out of existence. But most of Jagannatha's men escaped. A few threw themselves down on the path. The Major himself waved his arms for his men to run, not wanting to shout and risk dislodging more snow. Anya caught the impression that at least some of the camouflage-clad party thugs remained on the far side of the slide, but the wave of packed snow and thrown-up powder blotted them from sight. She felt Pan's hand clamp on her arm and tow her forcibly along the trail. The blizzard shut off her vision like a curtain falling. Jagannatha stood staring at the turbulent wall of white advancing toward him. The last remnants of loose snow sifted down over the ramp of snow where the trail had been. Although the slide's main force had missed most of them, his men had thrown themselves down against the trail's rocky inner face as its fringes swept over them. Now they picked themselves up and cleaned themselves off. Only their leader had remained standing, stubborn as a rock fixed to the white mountain itself. With an angry grimace, Jagannatha thrust his pistol back in its holster and sealed the flap.
Group yourselves.
What about Comrade Chatura? Shouldn't we try to help him?
He knows everything. Let him fend for himself.
What if he's dead?
Then we don't need to trouble ourselves over him anymore, do we? Get the men tied together. Those Western interlopers aren't getting away on my watch.
For a moment, Anya felt completely disoriented. She'd never encountered a snowstorm before that so abruptly cut visibility to where she couldn't see her fingers if she stretched out her arm. The wind swirled around her. The cold cut at her exposed face like a bee swarm. She blinked ice-laden lashes to clear her eyes. Through the soles of her boots, she could still feel the death rumble of the avalanche's aftermath.
Move to the inside of the trail!
Prasad's small figure appeared from the enfolding white. It had a reassuring sense of balance and solidity to it.
Pull your goggles back down! They have yellow lenses. You should still see well enough.
Anya nodded and obeyed. More than any other trait, her ability to keep her head in a lethal crisis had kept her alive. It had saved her on several occasions, even before she received the unexpected and unasked-for gift of the Sword of Joan of Arc. Pan loomed up beside her, dark and solid. He put an arm around her. It felt strong and secure. She melted against his chest in a fervent hug. She didn't like to think of herself as a woman who needed a strong man's touch to pull herself together. She was not that kind of woman. He took his arm from around her shoulders. She felt him doing something at her waist. She realized he had her moving forward again through the blinding snow.
Prasad wants us to rope ourselves together. We have to keep moving! Jagannatha won't stop!
Okay.
On they pressed through the curious blizzard. It was like being inside a blender making a vanilla milkshake. Indeed, the snow fell so densely it felt like frigid liquid splashing against them. Anya spun. Without warning, the wolves were on them. A figure appeared, a leathered face grinning, holding a kukri at her head. Anya dodged the strike. And hacked the gorilla across the face. She was jerked halfway off her feet as Pan, bringing up the rear, tried to block two more attackers from getting to her. With a quick slash, she cut the rope binding them together. As one of Pan's opponents grappled with him, the other darted toward Anya. She saw his eyes widen as he caught sight of the blade she held. He ran straight onto her point. Still hoping Pan hadn't seen the weapon appear in her hand, Anya stooped to snatch up the kukri dropped by the man she'd just killed. She transferred it to her left hand and held the sword in her right. It would give her plausible deniability with Pan, at least. Abruptly, Pan brought a shin up between the legs of the man he grappled with, and his grip on Pan's knife wrist slackened. He then slammed the hilt into his attacker's face. Taking a step and driving from the hips, he hurled the man away from him. The man vanished into the churning whiteness. Then Pan and Anya were locked in a bizarre dance as men with big curved knives swarmed them. Anya parried and slashed and thrust for fur-covered bellies and hate-twisted faces. As best they could, they backed up along the trail. Prasad joined their fight without a sideways glance at Anya's unusual weapon. Lal appeared too, Enfield slung and kukri drawn to join the melee. Although the gorillas were determined and outnumbered the explorers, they couldn't outflank them on the narrow trail, especially once Lal returned. Red slush was building around their boots, and the slick rock footing threatened to send them after so many of their enemies. Then a man with a ferocious scowl and eyebrows and round, grizzle-bearded cheeks confronted Anya. She recognized Major Jagannatha himself. He swung at her with his kukri.
Why are you doing this? What have we done to you?
It's not what you do, it's who will follow. And then our land will no longer be ours.
Not at all fazed by her weapon, he hooked his blade over hers and pivoted hard to his left. The move torqued the hilt and levered the sword right out of her hand. It seemed to vanish in the blizzard, but Anya knew it had simply winked out of existence. Jagannatha tried to whip a rising backhand hack at her face. She blocked with the kukri she still held in her left hand. Jagannatha pressed her hard. He was single-mindedly trying to destroy her. With Anya fighting off-handed with an utterly strange weapon, he was going to win soon, too. Forced to focus totally on his whirlwind blade, Anya was unable to concentrate enough to call back the sword. Jagannatha was clearly a master of kukri close-in fighting. But she was strong, and her reflexes were quick. He pressed her back up the trail. It was mostly by luck she didn't take a wrong step and go over the edge, but suddenly her right foot slipped. Her fall allowed Jagannatha to press his advantage. It also gave Anya a split second to grasp the sword. She thrust out. He caught himself like a cat and leaped nimbly back from the sword's lethal point. Despite the way her head swam, Anya snapped herself upright with a gymnast's quickness. Seeing what he took for an opening, Jagannatha closed quickly. His kukri swung down for her face, but she whipped her blade straight up. It sheared the descending kukri off, where its blade narrowed. By pure reflex, she wheeled into a clockwise spinning back kick. She saw his last look of angry defiance, then he dropped over the edge in silence.